I don't know, in July, I think it was July 7th, 1968, which seemed to me to present a point of view that we could take. You might either be in favor of it or not, but it has some nice things to say. They are speaking of the passing of you and Kaufman, and of your both having been liberal scholars who cared for students and who had thought of the institution as an educational institution. I'm not quoting them exactly here. They said that this is no longer, I think they used the term, where the university is at. And they said what is needed is the, and they speak about the bloodshed and the police and that sort of thing. What is needed is the kind of chancellor who can do that sort of thing and not feel bad about it afterwards. Someone who can outwit the students and who could perhaps split the protesters. They also said we doubt whether either was personally responsible for the decision to use the police, but neither spoke out afterwards. And it just generally, it's a very, and they wish you luck in your subsequent career.
It's nice of them.
It wasn't the usual tone of the Cardinal, but
no.
it was a good editorial. Well, I'd like to ask to begin with, why Fleming left?
Well, I think clearly that Fleming left because during that year, in fact, within the 3 or 4 weeks before he made his decision, he was the prime candidate for the presidency of either, well, first of Minnesota and then Michigan. And I think Bob Fleming clearly, and it was his desire to be a university administrator. If you're going to be a university administrator, then certainly being the top person in the system or in the university is the most desirable position. And I can't think of anyone who had ambition to be university president who wouldn't rather be president of Minnesota or Michigan than chancellor of Wisconsin, on the grounds that even though Wisconsin may be as good or better university than either of both, that is a Madison campus, although some people would argue that, at least if you don't have anybody above you in the administrative structure interfering with or helping to call the shots for what you're going to do. And I know that Bob Fleming particularly was bothered by that, although he and Fred Harrington got along very well still. He had decisions that he was limited in his choice by Fred's own ambitions and Fred's own style of administration, Fred's own program. In fact, he suffered from having Fred in the same building. The system hadn't been at all clearly defined by then, and Fred maintained his office in Bascom Hall, and to many people he was still running the Madison campus. I think that clarified with each successive chancellor, and that Fred was in the building only 2 or 3 months and then moved to Van Hise, and that physical separation also was a symbolic one.
When you were chancellor.
When I was chancellor, and I think that was of considerable importance. But still, nobody has yet been able to work out this problem of the president of the system, or whatever he may be called, and the chancellors. And it has been particularly difficult where the head of the system was formerly the head of the major university that makes up the system. California went through that with Clark, well, first with, was it Stroud, then Clark Kerr, and finally, after Clark Kerr was forced to resign the presidency, they went outside the system completely to get a president. Oh, I guess they call him chancellor there as the head of it. I'm not sure whether it's chancellor or president. But in any event, they went outside the system. And I think that gave the Berkeley campus much more autonomy than it had had before. So, to make a long story short, if you're going to try to run a university, and a university in the traditional sense of a campus and a faculty, you're just a lot better off being number one than number two.
Especially if number one is Fred Harrington.
Yeah, or any, I think...
Do you think it was... Would it be,
I don't think it's just Fred Harrington. Fred Harrington is a prototype of the problem, but certainly the chancellors under Clark Kerr had exactly the same problem. The chancellors, when Clark Kerr himself was chancellor and Sproul was president, he faced the same problem.
Well, I was thinking of Weaver as president. It seemed to me at that point that the
By the time Weaver came, I had much more autonomy, actually, in the administration of the campus than Bob Fleming ever had. And that, in part, was because by then the system had really enlarged, and Fred Harrington had seen his role as the larger one rather than immediate interference with what went on or administration went on in the Madison campus. And also I demanded a bit more autonomy, although I didn't by any means have complete autonomy, especially when it came to dealing with the student matters. But I think just the fact that Fred moved over to Van Nuys Hall and really wanted to escape some of the problems in Madison campus, especially the student problems, which he wanted to put as much distance between himself as possible, excepting the regents wouldn't let him, of course. So that if you're going to be held responsible, it's much better to make your own decisions in times of trouble. And I think Bob Fleming clearly wanted to get out from under that kind of an arrangement. Moreover, it'd be hard to argue with taking the precedence of the University of Michigan. It's certainly one of the, all the ratings put it in the first five or six universities in America. It probably has more autonomy than any other state university. In many ways, it's just a private university paid for by the state. You know, it's a constitutional university. The legislature really has a hard time, even in these days, having much to say about what goes on there. They only appropriate the funds to the Board of Regents, and the Board of Regents decides with the administration how to spend them. So it probably has more autonomy than any state university in America. So, and it's a fine university. So I could even imagine somebody going from the presidency of the University of Wisconsin to presidency.
Oh, I see. Well, that would be if that's
but
the case.
But certainly from the chancellorship, easily. And I think Bob would have gone to Minnesota. He was ready to go. I know that to be true when the Michigan offer came. So that, I guess that explains that aspect of it.
Do you know did Harrington have much to do with his handling, his decisions about how to handle some of these?
No, I don't think so. I think he didn't pay much attention to it. As I say, he was trying to put distance between himself and responsibility for students. Mm-hmm. Oh yeah, from the beginning, and for which shows him to be a wise man. But I'm sure that Fred did not like some of the dealings that Bob had with the students, particularly bailing out students who had been arrested. Because the regents put great heat on Fred over that.
Oh, they did.
Oh yeah, the regents were very unhappy with Fleming because they said that he coddled the students too much. And so I'm sure he just did things like that completely on his own.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sure Fred did. If he'd have talked it over with Fred, I'm sure Fred would have said, "Don't do it."
So you presume he didn't talk it over?
No, I presume. I don't know, but I'd be almost certain he didn't. And I think the regents were probably by then putting a lot of heat on Fred about the student indiscipline and student affairs generally by that time. It had started to build up.
Although it wasn't yet as conservative as it became in
No, I think
year,
what
was
really
it?
Happened was, if you'll recall, I think it was the first time in history, but it's certainly the first time in modern history, that a governor had been in office long enough so that he could appoint the whole board. See, there were nine members and they served for 9 years, so every year, barring resignations and deaths, when you could appoint more, the governor would appoint a person to regents. And traditionally in this state, even though it's always been, up until recent years, predominantly a Republican state, and mainly with Republican governors, there's always been a Democrat, at least a token Democrat, left on the board. But Warren Knowles had become so upset about the student problems that he had appointed quite conservative people to the board, and people who were told by him, now look, the problem in the university and the thing that's getting the governor heat all over the state is the problem of the students, and so be tough on that. And I think Warren Knowles was a very good friend of the university, except for that.
Really?
Oh yeah. In fact, I'm a lifelong Democrat, but I would say in general, in the 32 years I've been here, we've fared better under Republican governors, almost without exception, than Democrats. And that's in part because the Democrats have been activists, and they tend to interfere more with the university and think they know more what the university should do than have the Republicans, who tend to sit back and say, well, let the university make its own decisions about what it wants to do until you get a public clamor like you had about the students. And then Warren got very active in that. But other than that, I found him very cooperative in what the university was doing. I think Fred Harrington would say the same thing. That was a source of considerable problem. He called me down to his office on two or three occasions to tell me that, essentially, that as he went around the state, of the most constant heat that he got was about student behavior in campus, and he didn't understand why we couldn't control it better than we did. But he was always very nice about it. That is, he never was, saying you better quit if you can't control him or anything of that sort. He just, as a good politician, was upset when the public was upset. So that the regents then, by that time, a number of them had been put on by Knowles with rather specific expression on his part that he wanted to push the administration toward more of a crackdown on the students. The last remaining non-Republicans both turned out to be liberals, if my memory serves me correctly about who was last. I have no doubt about their being liberals. One was the labor leader from Milwaukee. Was his name Jacobs? Marvelous old gentleman.
Yeah. I know DeBartolet, but
But those two were very stalwart defenders of the administration and were quite, they didn't necessarily understand why the students made the university their target, but they wanted they wanted the administration to treat the students fairly and to listen to their problems and rather than to necessarily crack down on them. But once DeBartolet was the last to go, and that must have happened sometime after I'd been in office.
Yes,
four or five months in the spring. And I remember our walking out his car together, and he said, well, you're going to have a hell of a time. He said, you have already, but these conservative members of the board are really going to give you all kinds of hell. I said I thought they already had, but he said, well, it'll be worse. And it was, although I don't know how much worse after that. It's already quite bad all along. Very seldom was there a board meeting in which the board, in talking to me, wouldn't spend most of their time on something or other that had occurred during the prior month in regard to students, in relation to students. And I never found many of that board much interested in the academic program in the university. Those weren't the issues they were concerned with primarily. I remember being in one meeting in which they had appointed a committee to come up with a long-term plan for the development of the University of Wisconsin at Milwaukee as an urban university. Bob Clodius had worked with the committee, and they had developed really a magnificent long-term plan. I think they'd worked 2 years on it. And we were meeting, I think, at Green Bay at that time. And I'm not sure whether the chairman, I guess the chairman was a member of the Board of Regents, but he and Bob were presenting the report. And after about 10 minutes, everybody was looking at all the regents were looking at their watch. And finally, somebody just spoke up, I don't remember who it was, and said, look, I don't know why we need to go on talking about this. We can all read it. Let's get on to the urgent matters. And the urgent matters had to do with things that were happening on the Madison campus in terms of students. And they then went on with that for a couple of hours, you know. And I don't even remember what it was at that time they were upset about, but whatever it was, that was what they wanted to talk about. And that was typical of many of the regent meetings. Fred used to try very hard to steer them away, and Fred was a great filibuster. He should have been a Southern senator. You know, they'd ask him a question about why students were permitted to do something or other, and Fred would start off with the history of American universities and relations between administration and faculty and parietals, and he'd do it by sections of the country. And you know, after a half hour, they'd all be about asleep, and they never really get around to answering the questions. My problem was always they'd ask me a question, and I'd answer it right off and straightforwardly, and usually in a way that they didn't like, for example. And one of them even told me, they weren't all unfriendly to me as a person, but my position was what they didn't like. One of them even told me, took me to one side one time and said, look, you know, if you get along, this was one of the Republican members, said, you know, you'd get along a lot better with this board if you didn't lecture us so much. And I said, well, I don't talk very much. He said, well, but whenever we ask you a question, you start talking about individual rights in a democracy and what the system of jurisprudence is, and that embarrasses us, and we don't like to be lectured about those things. And but Fred never lectured him. He just gave a historical statement. He was an expert on Chapter 9, I remember, in the legal code for Wisconsin, which sets up the universities, you know, and defines the campuses as state parks, and he'd go on into all the ramifications of that for the control of behavior on the campus and all the legal questions involved. You know, he was really a master filibuster. Now they'd get quite upset by that, but not as upset as they would at me, because I would just answer their questions very directly and usually in ways that they just didn't like. But I think in light of that, in light of the fact to go back to the original question, in light of the fact that this was a pretty hot place in Michigan in comparison, although they had lots of trouble, it was mild. You know, at the worst, Michigan never had anything that would approach the problems that we have here. And So it was a fine place to go, and it was time for a change and for an upwardly mobile academic administrator. You know, it's one of the top jobs in the United States. So I'm sure that's why Bob went.
I'd just like to ask you about the board. Were they at all awed by Harrington?
No, well, I don't know. I think the attitude of the board toward Harrington, you'd have to talk about what board. The earlier boards were much awed by, impressed, I think, by Fred's ability his grasp of the big issues in higher education, his knowledge of and his power to get money. And Fred always knew just what was going on in Washington, what was going to go on, and he had a lot of influence on what went on, both directly through his influence on people in administration or in the government administration and the Congress. Fred was very calm and testifier on all higher education bills, and he's forceful, you know, and he's big and impressive. And I think they probably might have been awed by Fred, but they were all that coupled with a very favorable impression of what he was doing for the university. Must have made him the regents feel that Fred was just a very excellent person to be president. Now, if you go to the later boards after trouble started, then they didn't seem terribly awed by Fred. They would tackle him on various issues, I thought quite often trying to embarrass him, but he never was embarrassed. If he didn't show it. And I think Fred had a certain ill-concealed contempt for most of them anyway. Fred was the kind of person who tended to ram the things down their throat if they didn't swallow them easily. I think by time the board that I knew while I was chancellor had come into power, they were quite resentful of Fred. And I think looking back over it, you could see it was just a matter of time before they would ask for Fred's resignation if things kept going on as they were.
So his attitude would backfire.
Yeah. On the other hand, there were people there, like DeBartolaton, who was a very strong supporter of Fred, although he didn't agree with everything Fred did by any means, but he's a very strong. Mr. Jacobs was a very strong supporter. Matt Werner was a very strong supporter of Fred. And you see, up until about that time, when there were two or three resignations and retirements from the board, that the board had been pretty much under the leadership of Arthur DeBartolaton. Even when there was a majority of Republicans, they didn't necessarily all vote together, and Arthur kind of whipped the rest of them into line, and so the alliance between Fred and Arthur was very successful. And I think, for the most part, for the good. And then, after Arthur, Fred's star just kept going down and continued to go down until finally, of course, his resignation, which I'm told, I don't know, was forced. Usually such resignations are. Mm-hmm. Guess I should say mine wasn't. I just quit. But when I told Fred Harrington I was going to resign, he said that he thought it was probably a good idea because he thought it would only be two or three or four months till the board forced me to resign or asked me to resign. And my main debate was, well, should I resign or wait for the fun of being fired, which I thought would be a marvelous thing, to be fired by this bunch of antediluvian conservatives. And then I decided, oh hell, it would split up the year. It would be very difficult in finding a replacement and so on. I better just quit. I'd had enough fighting by then anyway. But I did kind of cherish the notion of wouldn't it be fun to be the only chancellor ever fired and to be fired for being too liberal and so on anyway, but I wasn't quite up to the game.
Did you have your speech ready in case?
Oh, yes, I always have a speech ready. But in any event, I think Fred figured I was a liability by then. I think Fred and I understood each other pretty well. We'd known each other a long, long time. And although we'd never been bosom pals kinds of people, we had great respect for each other. And Fred and I had our differences while I was chancellor. It was always over students, never anything else.
That's about all that anybody thought about.
Well, I was in trouble on a lot of other things, you know. I was in trouble over the appointment of the dean of pharmacy and law.
Oh, well, that's right, yes.
And the director of the student union. All those things were big fights, you know. And Fred supported me on all of those, never wavered in his support. But it was the student things that of course, determined everything in those days. And Fred, I think, felt that I was too easy on the students. On the other hand, he was very worried about faculty support during that time. And he thought I had that, even though he probably didn't.
He was worried about it on his behalf or yours?
Well, it's whole effect on the university.
Mm. Oh, I see.
He didn't want the faculty. This faculty's never been much alienated from administration. There have been instances in the past, but in general, it's been the administration's been supportive of the faculty, and the faculty's been supportive of the administration. And I think Fred felt that this was an issue on which there might be quite a serious rupture. There was for a while. After all, the faculty. You remember after the Dow incident, the university committee met and came up with a resolution in support of me, because they knew there would be a resolution condemning me, and I suppose that was the strategy. They didn't consult me about it, but I think that was the strategy that they felt was the proper one to take. And you'll probably recall we had two meetings of the faculty. The first one went about 7 hours, and the next one about 5, with the Union Theater full and with two-way communication through closed-circuit television to several other places where faculty were. Of course, a lot of non-faculty got into the faculty meeting and voted and various other things. But anyway, I thought from the course of the speeches that were made in the faculty, certainly the first several hours, that the only thing that they would vote down the vote of confidence and I would just resign. And probably giving a ringing denunciation of faculty, but that I would resign. And but then on the second day, a few people spoke in support, and I could see increasingly, I said nothing during that whole time. I turned the meeting over to Jim
Cleary.
Who was vice chancellor and who was a masterful, an authority actually on parliamentary procedures. He's written a major book on Robert's Rules of Order historically and developed up to present. And he turned out to be a very good presiding officer and a very fair one, and I just turned the chair over to him after making a little statement at the beginning of the meeting. And it wasn't until after the vote that I said a word. But then when the vote came at the end of the second day, you could see, I could tell a shift. Or what I could really sense was that the people who were verbal and vocal about it were not being supported by the silent ones. And so when the vote finally came, you know, it was about 2-1 in favor of the resolution, as I recall. But I don't know how I got started on that, other than to say, that there was a real split with faculty.
Mm-hmm.
And I felt that it was very necessary to heal that breach. The split in the faculty here was no different than any place else that had real trouble. Berkeley was even worse split than we were, and remained split for much longer. Our faculty very rapidly came back to essentially a supportive position, and Fred was very worried about that split, as he had good reason to be. And I think Fred felt that some of the actions that I took, such as appointing a student-faculty committee to come up with rules governing conduct in such matters, that was the Crow Committee, as mm-hmm. I recall, and then another committee to come up with a more appropriate system of hearings for people charged with violation of university regulations. We got, I think, Merriman.
Mm.
Yeah, Sam Merriman was chairman of that committee. And people got working very hard on those things, and we had all sorts of hearings and faculty meetings on their report and so on. And I think those things tended to heal the breach much more rapidly than it was healed in other places. And in part, it was because the faculty really wanted to support the administration, but they were distressed that violence had occurred, and they were distressed that the administration had had any part in the responsibility for violence. It didn't seem to distress them. Well, I'm sure it distressed them, but not so that they'd make public outcries that the students were behaving violently. There wasn't much protest about that from the faculty, actually, although many individuals talked about it a good deal. But sitting in buildings had taken place, you know, a number of times during the Fleming period, and the feeling, I think, on the part of the faculty was that that wasn't proper behavior, but after all, it was the administration's problem. But when it became apparent that the students were turning not only against the administration, but the faculty as well, then the faculty got quite upset.
Mm-hmm.
You know, most faculty members see themselves, they don't admit it, as kind of substitute parents to the young people who come, and they really want their love and respect, and when they don't get it, they just feel terrible about it. And I think some faculties, Columbia and Berkeley, much more so than here, just couldn't recover from it. And Harvard, especially, you know, what happened to Harvard was, you know, was petty in comparison with Berkeley or here. And yet, you would think if you talk to Easterners that the whole trouble started, you know, at Columbia and Harvard. I mean, we had it at least a year we had had it for 2 or 3 years before, and we'd had bad trouble long before anything happened at either of those places. So that, but the faculty at those places was probably much more alienated from the administration than here.
Well, the difference here is that precisely the faculty who would be most caring about their students were the ones who were most sympathetic with them.
Yeah.
So
I think that's true.
They would, and also who liked you.
Yeah, that was a conflict for a lot of people, I'm sure, was that there was a certain amount of personal like and a certain amount of understanding that I was in a hell of a mess, partly at the faculty's making.
Mm-hmm.
It was the faculty that had just the spring before, 9-1, voted in favor of continuing interviews on this campus and insisting that people be able to freely be interviewed and so on, you know. It was the faculty who had done all that. And then when the crunch came and troubles resulted, the faculty, of course, felt, except for a few of the wilder ones, felt quite embarrassed that they were now in process, at least in those meetings, of arguing whether to support or condemn somebody who had tried at least half-heartedly to carry out their mandate.
Well, let's go back to that vote in the spring. What interested me was what your own feeling at that time was about whether protests should be allowed and what.
My feeling. You mean at the time?
Well,
in
how
the
did
spring,
you vote?
How did I vote? Hmm. I voted against it.
You did.
Yes.
You were one
because
of the
I
one
believe,
among the one.
I believe that. I believe that it wasn't the business of the university to run placement agencies anyway, and that there was no reason why we should get ourselves in trouble over it when Dow or General Electric or Boeing or anybody else could rent rooms just like I read the New York Times, you know. Full page ads in those days about Dow and Boeing and all these companies. They'd be at the Roosevelt Hotel to talk to students. You know, they didn't necessarily go to campuses. They don't in big cities. And I saw no reason why the reason we had here, traditionally, for providing space for people to be interviewed was convenience of students.
Mm-hmm.
But if it was going to get us in a hell of a lot of trouble, avoid the trouble, you know.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't a great moral issue with me. It was just, if this is a source of trouble, let Dow take care of their own troubles. We have nothing of our own.
That's good.
And so I was opposed to it then. I was opposed to it all along. I was also opposed to the war, but I never believed that the university should be the target of protest. I felt that this university, of all the universities I knew about, was least involved in any complicity with the government on our Vietnam policy, and moreover, it seemed to me that, you know, if you want to protest, go protest where the action is, not where it isn't.
I see. So you're on.
So I've always been opposed. I was opposed to war from the very beginning, and I publicly stated that, and publicly demonstrated it. But I believed that the way you did such things was in meetings, and you got up and said what you thought about it. It never occurred to me that the way to do it was to take over buildings or to burn buildings or to bomb buildings or anything else. I thought that citizens ought to assemble where they are and protest, but that didn't mean closing down the university. I could see no point in that. I never did, and to this day I don't. The other thing was that I always felt that if I really felt the university were guilty of complicity, I'd do everything I could to try to publicly force the university to change its policies, and I might even be willing to engage in non-violent kinds of actions. In the tradition, in the Gandhian tradition, and take my medicine for it. But it never occurred to me, and it still doesn't seem to me correct, to assume that you can openly violate the laws and the rules and not be willing to pay whatever penalties have to be extracted as a means of change.
How did you feel about Fleming's handling of that spring Dow protest?
You mean bailing the kids out of jail?
Mm.
Well, I thought that was a nice thing to do. I never would have.
Mm.
Mm-hmm. Hell with them. If they want to engage in things to get them arrested, let them take care of their own arrest. I didn't see any reason why the university should have. But I thought that was a nice, humane thing to do. I would never have done that. I just figure, you know, if you want to do illegal things and disruptive things, take your medicine. the medicine isn't all that bad, you know. They'd have been hauled up in court and fined $25, stay in the caboose overnight. Mm-hmm. I don't think it would have hurt any of them.
Did you know personally any of the people who were involved?
Oh, yes.
Evan Stark, of course, was in sociology. Did you know him?
I knew him very well. I had him in seminars.
You did?
Evan was the genius behind the whole thing. He was the planner, the master
yes.
strategist mm-hmm. of the whole thing. And I knew Evan quite well.
What is your assessment of him?
Well, that's kind of a difficult question to ask. He's bright. I think essentially unprincipled. Kind of guy that takes advantage of any situation that he can to promote whatever aims he may have at the moment. He came and talked to me a couple days before the Dow interviews, and he said, I think there's going to be real trouble, and I'll do everything I can to prevent it, and all I ask of you is that if things get out of hand and there have to be forces brought on the campus, I hope you don't do it, but if you do, then I want you to promise not to let the deputy, or the sheriff with his dogs and deputies on the campus, because they'd like to beat hell out of the students. And I said, there's no way I can promise you anything. I said, I hope nothing happens if they have to come. But, and I don't intend to call them. I don't intend to call anybody. But if the police come and they want additional forces, nothing I can do about it. They'll just call whomever they can get. And he said, well, he'd do everything he could to prevent it. But truth is, he planned the whole thing.
Yeah.
From beginning to end. And then, you notice, he was not in the building when the police went in. He was outside.
Mm-hmm.
And he suffered, nor was Bobby Cohen inside. The innocents were inside, and they were outside watching the fracas. But anyway, as an indication of Evan's character, after he left here, he went to Canada because he was in a draft category, you know. He was an exempt status and whatever the student deferment was.
Mm.
But they'd been putting a lot of heat on him, and he knew if he got involved in something like this, was kicked out of school or the courts got too in debt, that he would be, he'd lose his draft status. So he went to Canada, or at least, I don't know if he went to Canada, that's what people say. He left that within the hour after the thing was over. And unlike Bobby Cohen, who stayed here and faced the music of the whole thing. And then nobody around here heard a thing about him until two or three years later. And then by then, he had passed the draft age, and maybe the war was winding down by then. But he went to Minneapolis, where he and Lee Zeldin, who was a woman who wasn't a student, but who was very active in the student affairs, or in the student disruptions of the time, were working on an OEO, poverty program, organizing the poor somewhere as federal employees. But anyway, to make a long story short, one of my friends at UCLA knew Evan and knew about him, sent me a picture of Evan with a two-column story on the first page of the Los Angeles Times, saying blue-collar workman takes part in panel on poverty or whatever it was. And Evan was representing himself as a Minneapolis working slob who was appearing on this panel, and he was quoted as saying, before I came to this When I accepted this, I didn't realize how difficult it would be for me to talk this bunch with this bunch of learned panelists, professors, and deans, and so on. And he said, so I waited until 10 o'clock till the bar opened, got three stiff jolts of whiskey before I could appear here and talk. Here is a guy whose father is a eminent professor and was raised in a professorial family.
Where is his father a professor?
I believe at Brandeis. But it's either Brandeis or one of the city colleges. Well, I'm quite sure it's Brandeis. But in any event, here's an academic brat, you know, putting on this act, which is typical of Evan. I wouldn't trust him as far as I can throw him on any question. He's now a graduate student again at Yale, I understand.
Oh, is that right?
Social policy or social planning or something of that sort. He's very bright. He's a smart guy, but I think, you know, my reading is that he's essentially a without character and an opportunist. He abandoned the student movement the minute he got in trouble. He wasn't in any part of, you know, he left, deserted the cause, so to speak, rather than staying here like at least Bobby Cohen did to face charges and to represent the student position. So I never...
Then I didn't see him for several weeks.
This was probably the spring before I became chancellor. And I didn't see him for several weeks, and finally I saw him out in the hall, and I said, Evan, you seem to have quit the seminar. Have you dropped it? And he said, oh, no. No, no. And I said, well, were you upset by what I said the other day? Oh, no. He said, that's okay. Never even thought about it. And I said, well, then why haven't you been coming? He said, well, I'm organizing a strike at Sears. And he said, when I get that all settled, I'll come back and make up the work for the seminar. He still got me incomplete. I don't think he ever finished it. But, you know, the intellectual life was not all that important to him, I don't think. I never could quite make out, you know, his motive structure. I didn't know him all that well, but it seemed to me he just kind of wanted to be in the forefront of the radical movement. I haven't any doubt of his conviction of about the war.
Oh, you don't? I was going to ask you.
Oh, no, I don't know. You know, I don't know how anybody hardly could have failed to be upset by the war.
But he was upset.
That's the point.
I'm sure he was
genuinely upset. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, he's a very complicated guy, and I think he saw this as a chance to get a hold of the student movement in one university, at least, and to run it. And that's what he was doing. And, well, you know, there were all sorts of incidents that took place long before that he was engaged in. You remember, there was one big fuss about him burning an American flag in front of the Union, and there were all sorts of things that he was engaged in the year or so before. So that
somebody else did that too.
Yeah.
Is that right?
Oh yes, that was a common trick those days. But he did. So I'm sure that he was sincere in his protests against the war.
Was he a genuine a radical? Was he an SDS member? Do you know?
I don't know, but I'm sure. I would guess that he was, sure. Mm. I don't know that, but he was a genuine radical. I don't think there's any question about that he believed in the overthrow of the government. Mm-hmm. And he was like most of the radical students that I got to know at all. He was a real elitist, you know. They always talked about the poor exploited working classes and the poor blacks and so on, but they were going to do something for him. They were not going to bring them into the... into the decision structure by any means, but they knew what was good for exploited people. And, you know, I never knew whether he was a Marxist, a Maoist, or what he was. None of those people was ever very clear, you know. Our generation, especially my generation, who finished college during the Depression and many of whom were socialists or had turned to socialism or to Marx or to communism, Russian style or Stalinism. They were ideologues, you know. They could give you the answers from anything, and they'd argue great hours in public debate, you know. The socialists would debate the communists and so on and refute each other, all that sort of thing, in their interpretation of Marx and Lenin. But these kids had no such fix, and my generation couldn't understand that. I remember Don Anderson was the editor of the, longtime editor of the Wisconsin State Journal. And he couldn't get it out of his head that these people weren't being paid huge sums of money by the communist underground, you know. And he couldn't believe it when I'd tell him that they'd condemn the Russians on many grounds. Mm-hmm. Well, that was just a front. And the truth is, I think they were much more Maoist than Stalinists, but they didn't know what they were. They weren't, you know, in any real sense, they had no set ideology. And that made one of the things, you know, for a period of time, there was a focusing among liberal and radical students, there was a focusing on the war that brought them together. They had they were greatly upset by the war. They were also upset by their own escape from the costs of the war, very much, deeply, psychologically upset by that. And that brought them together. They had a common focus. Didn't matter whether you were Maoist or Marxist or Quaker or what in hell you were, just if you were opposed to the war, you were willing to go to meetings and maybe even do things. There were a lot of kids who were in that building when the Dow riots took place, when the police went into the Commerce Building. There were kids sitting there thinking that this would be, yes, I thought it would be, actually, primarily a symbolic protest. Yeah. They'd sit there, the police would come in and arrest them. Mm-hmm. We had arranged for buses and trucks to take them down to the police station, I think even numbers to pin on them, you know, so they could appear and be charged. And that they would leave without any resistance. After all, there'd never been any resistance here or Berkeley or any place else before, and that's what we had planned for. And there were all sorts of kids in there, you know, who were there just like good Quaker kids or peaceniks of any kind, traditional, religious, or whatever, philosophical grounds, who were opposed to war, and who intended no violence whatsoever. And it's still, you know, completely unknown what happened when the cops went in. The police claim that when they tried to get into the building, they were repulsed by the students, and some of them were hit with bricks and various other things. And, you know, they just kind of blew them right out through the doors. And then they regrouped, and when they went in, they just smacked everybody in sight, as far as I can learn. And a lot of these kids were sitting there, you know, with their hands folded, getting their heads hit. Yeah. I wasn't in there, so I don't know what actually happened, but those are kinds of stories that I got from people who were
what is the name of the report? The Scotton Report is
called. Yes.
I don't want to get too far ahead of where I want to be.
Yeah.
We're talking about Evan Stark, and since we're talking about him, there's Bob Cohen and Henry Hazlack.
Yeah.
And Bob Zwicker. They were all.
Yeah.
Did you know the others as well as Evan
Stark? Not
as well
as Evan, but I knew Cohen fairly well.
And you have a higher regard for him, I gather.
Yeah, Bobby Cohen was a different kind of a guy. He was not a crafty planner of things. He was a spokesman and an orator. He couldn't resist the opportunity to orate. Now, Evan was a good talker, but nothing like Bobby Cohen. Mm. And so Bobby, I think, was more the tool of Evan than anything else. Although, again, he was philosophically committed to what he was doing.
Yeah.
But I don't think Bobby had any intent that there be violence. I don't think he's that sort of a guy at all. But he spoke for them
He spoke for the students, and he was very effective. And he as an example of how he loved to talk and speak, you know, he demanded sometime after the Dow thing to go and speak to the regents in defense of his unwillingness to or his dismissal of his attorneys or in that trial, having and stomping out of the building, and then the hearing group, which George Young was then dean of the law school, on just kicked him out of school for what they did there, mm-hmm. which you can do. I didn't know that. In a court of law, if you disobey the law, you can you don't need any trial. It's there and it's public and fame. You can be sentenced. But in any event, George followed the legal procedures when Cohen dismissed the attorney, and it was Cohen, Zwicker, and somebody else, I forgot now who were under hearing, but who were being tried there or having a hearing. He dismissed his attorney and then turned on the hearing board and condemned them personally, and among other things, he said George Young was a drunken idiot or something, and so on. And so they just threw him out of school right then. I thought that was a big mistake. I thought they should have kept their cool and adjourned the thing and gone into conference and then decided what to do. Well, they did. They just adjourned it and walked in another room, and then they decided within 10 minutes what to do to these guys. But anyway, they did it, so you had to live with it. Well, then Cohen demanded a hearing before the regents, and some prominent liberal members of our faculty counseled him a good deal about what he should claim there.
People like Anatole Beck?
Well, I won't say like whom, because I'm not that sure who they were, but he was told that, go before the board and make your case, say that these were bad times and these were terrible things that were going on in the war, and that you were very much opposed to all this, and the voice of students hadn't been properly heard in federal or local places of power, and that in your frustration you had done certain things. You're not sorry for them because you knew of no other recourse available to you, and that when you felt that the hearing you weren't being well represented by your attorney, and that possibly the hearing board was not sympathetic with your position, that you said some things you shouldn't have said. Well, that was what he was to say, I'm told. Instead, he went in and ended up giving the regents hell for all of their oppressive measures, and finally said that they were the biggest, that he had never stood before nine such complete cretins in all of his life, and on he went, you know. Well, anyway, he then left here. Fred fired him, as you recall.
Yes.
And I protested that, not because I had any love for him, but because I felt that we're getting, well, I have deep feelings about what justice is and how it ought to be carried out. I think in what I said, I don't even have a copy of it anymore, I said that the university certainly could afford to suffer some indignities from individuals in order to see to it that fair hearings took place, and that it was part of our duty to teach young people what the system of jurisprudence was all about, and that there were procedures set up for dismissal of members of teaching staff, and that I thought they should be adhered to, and so on and so on. And but I would have done that whether it had been Cohen or anybody else. There's no personal love for him by any means. He got me into all kinds of trouble. It was just that I didn't think that in times of stress you could afford in the university to abandon the usual mechanisms that you use. You're trying to force the students to follow the usual mechanisms, and certainly the administration had to be as willing to do so. And I argued with Fred at length on three different times that day about this.
Oh, really?
And
he didn't agree with you.
Oh, I think he probably agreed with me, but I think he felt that he had to do it. The regents were demanding that Cohen be fired, I'm sure. He didn't say that to me in so many words, but I'm sure that's what it was. I think he didn't think it'd make that much difference anyway, and it didn't. You know, I don't think it cost
him. Well, they didn't fire him, in fact, so. I mean, he didn't. He stayed. Cohen did.
I don't recall.
He was kept, yeah.
Was he kept on in this job?
Well, I think then
think
he
so.
Had the trial, but wasn't the point that he was fired before he'd had his trial?
Oh no, but he wasn't fired. He wasn't fired for by Fred. He wasn't fired for what he did as a student. He was fired for neglect of his teaching duties,
yes,
or something.
But
like
the
that.
Thing is that your
trial
opinion
would
prevailed.
Have nothing to do with that with his teaching duties.
I think we'll the tape is coming to an end, so we'll.
Well, he had to do something to appease the regents, the legislature, and the people of the state.
Mm-hmm.
And they were all, especially, the people of the state knew much more about Bobby Cohen than they did Evan Stark. It was only the insiders that knew Evan, because
yes.
He didn't play the public game.
Mm-hmm.
So the spokesman was Bobby, and he was the one that had everybody infuriated, you know. And I think Fred just figured, well, you know, it was a fluke that he was on the staff to begin with, and that he ought to, that it would help the university in its position with the state, with the governor, with the regent, certainly, to get rid of this guy. So he felt that move had to be taken.
Yeah.
And I, as I say, I really think that Fred was kind of pleased, in a sense, that I opposed him and wouldn't fire him. See, Fred asked me to fire him, which I wouldn't do.
Yeah.
And then he said he would. And I tried to talk him out of that, and I gave him all the reasons. And he said, well, I'll, those are forceful reasons, I'll think about it. And then he appeared on television at the 6 o'clock news saying he'd fired him, and Fred had gone to Notre Dame for some reason that afternoon, so he must have made that up.
Yeah.
Early in the afternoon he must have made the tape, because he was present, you know, saying it. But in any event, I think Fred figured that that had to be done. It was a small sacrificial lamb to slaughter at that point. And I think he figured that, okay, that would cost him some faculty support. But the fact that I came out in opposition to what he had done would kind of recapture it, you know, in
yeah,
a sense.
Yeah.
Although I certainly didn't have that as my intent, nor, I think, did he. I think that's the way it worked out, in that he was smart enough to see that it would kind of work out that
yeah.
way. It faculty be mad at him, but they'd be kind of pleased
but only
with me.
It would be only one segment of the faculty who would be mad at him. The rest would
no,
be very much
I
in favor of
it. So. No, I don't think that's so. I absolutely don't think that's so. I think this faculty is so concerned with following of faculty procedures and dismissal, they might say the bastard should be fired,
yeah.
but not without a hearing.
You really think
oh,
so?
Oh yes, I don't think there's any question about it. The one thing that I encountered in dealing with the faculty during that period, and why, whereas there were little delegations of 8 to 10 people who wanted to see me almost every day from the faculty, from the liberal segment of the faculty to tell me what to do or to protest what I was doing or to give me guidance and inspiration or whatever it might be. There were occasions when I was confronted with the conservative members of the faculty. It turned out that the university committee was very conservative.
Yes.
And I had been their president when I, or I mean their chairman when I became chancellor, so I knew all those guys very well. And they used to call me in periodically to say, look, we're trying to support you, but you've just got to take a firmer stand against these students and so on, you know, and I'd lecture them the same way as I did the regents, and then I'd keep pointing out to them when they'd say, well, we're going to do this, that, the other thing. I'd point out to them the difference between being charged with the administration of the university and charged with policy making. They could make policies, but they weren't running this university, and it used to just make a matter in hell because I keep pointing that out, but it was true. Well, still, they supported me all the way through, but every one of those people believed in due process. Every one of them. And I remember I was asked to go to the two then most conservative faculties to appear after the Dahl thing and after and my statements about the interviewing and all that sort of thing and appointing these committees and so on. One was the faculty of the School of Engineering. And man, they were really upset. And but with all of their admonitions of how we've got to crack down on the students, how we've got to prevent violence, how we've got to prevent interference with orderly procedures and so on, with the exception of one man whom I don't even know, who got up and said, well, we ought to do like Hitler did when the German radical youth rose up against him in the early days of his regime, get machine guns and tanks and just mold the bastards down, and the engineering faculty booed. You know, they wanted a much tougher line, but they didn't want you to. I wouldn't doubt what they were all used to. You know, for 100 years in American universities and colleges, people have been thrown out by the dean without any hearing. And I think they kind of were sad that those days were gone forever, because there had been federal case after federal case, you know, in which they'd put the kids back in school. And they knew about that vaguely. And I, of course, told them about it, too, when I was explaining why you couldn't throw people out. But in general, I would say the faculty was supportive of orderly procedures, of procedures that were fair to students, that didn't prejudge their guilt, and so on. And so I think that even though they hated, much of the faculty too thought that Cohen was the great leader of all this, the plotter and the planner, and being the mouth for it, and the spokesman, of course, he got all the publicity, and most of the faculty didn't know what was going on anyway. So you're sitting over in your office in Ag Hall, and you hear that the students have taken over the Peterson Hall or something, and you think what a horrible thing it is, but you go on about your business and you don't do much about it. And I think that was true of most of the faculty. And when it came to their attention that there were required procedures and so on, they believed in them, and especially they believed in them when it came to anything like an academic person. Even though Bobby Cohen was a TA and not an instructor or assistant professor, still there were procedures, and they knew there were, and they wanted those procedures followed.
Yeah, I'm very glad you said
that. It's partly their own. Self-interest.
Yes, of course, but still.
And that's also
it's something to recognize
decency
that.
Decency and fair play.
This ties in with the, when I interviewed Edwin Young, his comment that this is during the TA strike, he didn't worry about the vocal members, the liberal vocal members of the faculty. He said it was the quiet ones off in the ag campus, the worldwide scholars whose opinions worried him, and that's why I said, when you said Harrington was worried about the faculty who might oppose him, but you're saying it would have been including those quiet ones.
Not all of them, but it would have been a lot of them.
Mm.
You know how all those things are. Nobody's very absolute about such things. They might have said, well, you can bend procedures a little, and you've got a guy that's as bad as this fellow, as flagrant as he is, a man who goes before the regents and calls them cretins, and who doesn't behave nicely in public and so on. They might say, well, I won't feel as bad about that as if he'd dismiss somebody that didn't behave in those ways. But still, this faculty has been... It's not an accident, I think, that this faculty has historically taken
a strong position on faculty freedom of expression, all going back to the flack on Bascom Hall that everybody talks about and points
yes,
at.
Don't say it.
But in any event, Cohen was not then much of a schemer, much of an organizer. He was a spokesman. And as I say, he stayed, took his medicine, then went to University of Buffalo, where he again got involved in things. The philosophy department there hired him, I think, as an instructor. And he got involved in things there. I always remember, I was at a conference on the student revolt that the American Academy of Arts and Sciences held in Boston. You know, they print Daedalus. And the person who was running it, they broke the group. There were about probably 40 people invited, and many of them gave papers and others comments, and then there's a good deal of discussion. I guess you know how those kind of, they go for two or three days, and then a few months later they get people to revise their papers and publish them in Daedalus. But in any event, they were ushering us off to the various rooms we were assigned to, and the fellow who was running it said, "Now you will be with Marty Masterson, Meyerson in such and such a room." He said, "Do you?" And just then he came up and he said, "Do you know each other?" See, he had been chancellor at Berkeley during some of the troubles, and then went on to Buffalo as president of SUNY Buffalo. And he said, "Do I know him? He's the bastard that sent me Bernie Cohen." Or what was his name?
Bobby
Cohen.
Yeah.
So he knew me.
Yeah.
But anyway, I don't know what's ever happened to Bobby since, and somebody told me he got his PhD finally, is in academic life somewhere.
I've heard he's still in Buffalo, but that's...
He may be,
I
just don't know.
Did you know Hank Haslack?
Not very well. He was kind of a... He was a, by then, even a perennial math TA, as I recall. And he used to come in and talk to me about the union, not about these troubles.
Mm-hmm. So he was
a very humorless sort of a guy, I thought. I didn't really have much to do with him, nor did he really have much to do with the student movement.
No, he wasn't involved in the...
He was involved.
In the first doubt, but not in the second one.
But he wasn't.
Yeah.
He wasn't any great shakes in the student movement, but he was a fairly important figure, I guess, in the TIAA.
Yeah.
Or what? Well, not TIAA. Teaching Assistants Association.
Yeah. Is this a time to ask about Paul Soglin?
It's as good a time as any. You were going to ask me about that other fellow. What was his name?
Oh, Zwicker. Bob Zwicker.
Bob Zwicker. I knew Bob Zwicker because he used to come in once in a while. He was the Madison, or he was the local boy, you know.
I don't know anything about him.
He's a Wisconsin boy from some place up. Oh, gosh, I don't even remember the community, but from a Wisconsin
family. That's nice.
Family.
I'm glad there was some Wisconsin.
And he was a very handsome, big fellow. And Ralph Hansen, who got along extremely well with the radical students, for somebody who had to be policeman to him, he just hated and feared that guy. He thought he was a true radical in the sense that he would do terrible things if called upon, and he and whenever any place, remember during that year they firebombed South Hall and burned out the dean's offices, trying to describe the records of which we had copies all over the place. You know, a typical syndicalist sort of a thing. If you can destroy the records, you'll grind this monster to a halt, and so on. And Ralph immediately suspected that must be the guy that did. Didn't matter what happened around here, he thought Bob Zwicker.
More so
was
than
the
Evan Stark or Bob Brown.
Oh, yes, because he didn't see them as the desperate
types who would do things.
Swinburne was an undergraduate, wasn't he?
He was an undergraduate in, I don't know, I have any idea whether rightly or wrongly, Ralph just saw him as the kind of guy who would throw a bomb, who would light a building, who would do the violence.
That's the way some
things.
People felt about Marchetti later on.
Yeah, and I don't really know. You know, I used to kid Ralph about his mania against this fellow, but I never really knew him very well. He was the one that during the trial, there wasn't room in the law courtroom over there, in the law school trial courtroom, and they had filled every seat, and he came and opened windows and crawled through the windows and wouldn't leave with a bunch of other people and disrupted the trial and all. They were all upset about that. But anyway, I really don't know much about that boy at all. I met him once or twice. He was not nearly as intellectually oriented as the other fellows. But Ralph really thought he was a dangerous fellow, and I don't know whether he had any basis for that.
To talk to him.
Well, you ought to talk to Ralph,
yes,
if you haven't, about the whole affair, because he knows more about it than anybody.
Yeah.
Now, you're asking about Paul Soglin.
Mm.
Paul Soglin was a minor figure in whatever happened on the campus. He's tried to make political capital of it, and has succeeded in doing it. Again, he was a talker, not a doer. As far as I know, Paul was never apprehended in anything.
Mm-hmm.
His greatest claim to fame was in that university forum after the Dow affair. He made his speech. There were, you know, there was this university forum,
yes,
with several, well, the place was absolutely, the Union Theater was packed for it. And all my advisors and friends had urged me to make this public appearance, in fact, to suggest the forum, which I did, to the forum committee, and that this would be a chance for me to say my piece, which I first did, and for others to talk, and Paul was going to represent the student view or something. I forgot who all was on it, but nobody paid any attention to anybody but me.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when I walked in the room, I knew there's going to be trouble, because there was just a chorus of boos that followed me all the way to the platform. This was being broadcast all over the state.
How did that make you feel?
Oh, I felt terrible. But it didn't give me
angry or
no,
betrayed or
no, not betrayed. I never felt betrayed by anybody. You know, I'm too much of a realist for that. I guess I felt a little at first let down by the faculty, not necessarily betrayed, as I thought they were kind of pursuing their own self-interest and so on. But
this would have been booze from students.
Oh, sure.
Yeah.
And the place was packed with radical students. Nobody else could get in. And of course, they booed me and hissed.
Mm.
Whenever I'd say anything, they'd hiss and so on. And then there were no questions directed to anybody but me. And people were planted all over the place to raise the questions. And I must answer questions for an hour until it was just the same old stuff over and over again. And I said, I just don't see any point.
Were they specific or were they general?
Oh,
were they
no,
about
general things about
the war and the university and down.
And me and why I didn't have the courage of my stated convictions about the war, and why had I muzzled some people. Joe Kaufman had gotten out some kind of a federal restraining order against certain student radicals,
yeah,
making speeches on the campus or holding gatherings or something. And I really had nothing to do with that, but Joe did it. And
that was after Dow, was it?
After Dow, yeah, a couple weeks after Dow. And then they went to the federal courts and got it changed, you know, whatever. There was just, we were in federal court all the time. I never went
Soglin
there.
Was the leader of that, as I understand it, but maybe that's a different
You better
point.
Look it up.
Yeah.
Because Soglin claims a lot of things that weren't so. But anyway, Soglin was the spokesman at that meeting. Mm-hmm. He spoke. And at a certain point in the proceedings after he'd given his speech, he raised his hands on signal, and about 400 of them followed him out of the room screaming, "You fascist bastard, you've got blood on your hands." I've got a tape of that, you know. I could put, if I wanted to ruin Paul in an election, I could play that tape, but I've never done it. But anyhow.
I didn't realize he was that involved in that part of
it. He wasn't. He was just involved in the, I mean, I don't think he necessarily planted people there or questions. Mm. But Paul has always got his finger in the air to see where the wind's blowing politically. Mm-hmm. Paul, I think, has got as little firm philosophical convictions as Evan Stark. You know, mm-hmm. he'll do whatever it takes to get elected, whatever it is to have a following. And at that mm-hmm. time, he wanted to take over the student movement. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, he did what he thought would help him to do it. But he never did. Nobody ever took it over again. You know, it's really true that from the passing of Evan Stark and Bobby Cohen from the scene, which they did effectively mm-hmm. at that point, never after that was there an organized student movement on this campus. Nobody was able to take it over. Various people tried. Paul, I'm sure, thought he was doing it or might have a chance.
Do you think he didn't have the strength of personality to do it, or
well,
if he
I
was trying
idea.
To.
I don't know that he really wanted to do that bad. I shouldn't make that inference. I think he was opposed to the war. You know, he was floating around. He thought he was a graduate student in history. Your department, history kept kicking him out because he wasn't getting anything done. Hadn't for years, you know. Hmm. He was driving taxi cab, and he was into this, that, and the other thing. And I don't think he was at all settled about what he wanted to do in life. And it was only after that, some years after that, that he came back to law school, you know.
He did run for alderman that spring.
Yes, he ran for alderman.
And was elected, in fact.
And was elected, yeah. And in a student district. But still, I don't know what you mean by a student leader. I mean somebody that can organize them and get things done.
Yeah, well, I do mean that.
And that wasn't Paul.
And he wasn't able to do it, yeah. Or always.
I don't know that he even tried.
Yeah.
I don't know that he even tried.
Yeah.
But he was certainly not, you know, he didn't have a following of convicted people who would do what he wanted mm-hmm. done, which Evan Stark had, and which Evan and Bobby had together. And, there were various people among students who tried to take over their role, but none of them ever succeeded. I remember two boys, I can't even remember their names, a pair of twins came into my office one day. They were New York kids, and they said to me that, "We're organizing, we have a plan to put you out of this office, and one of us will be sitting in your chair. We're going to run this university before this year's over." And I said, "Well, that's very interesting. I'd love to know how you're going to do that." And they said, "Well, there are 7,000 kids in the dorms, and we're going to organize those dormies. And boy, when we get those 7,000 behind it, it's not going to be these few hundreds of kids that will be behind the various other radicals around here, and we're going to put you down in the basement in that office down there, and we're going to run this university." And I said, "Well, guys, you know, that's interesting to me. I just wondered how you're going to get them organized, because nobody else has ever been able to organize them in an election or anything else. So the most unorganizable people in the world. Well, we'll do it. We'll take up issues like food and visiting hours and so on, you know," and I never heard of them again. But there were various people who wanted to be leaders.
Were they undergraduates?
Yeah, they were undergraduates. Mm. I think they were juniors at the time. Uh-huh. I can't even remember their names. I'm sure Bert Fisher would remember.
It'd be nice to know what
has
happened to them.
But, it'd be nice to know what's happened to a lot of the people. But in any event, I would say Paul's role was really small. He had nothing to do with the big things that happened. Yeah. Earlier, he had nothing to do with them. Yeah. And then when the Dow thing came again, he wasn't in the building. He hadn't made any statements. He wasn't even involved in it, so far as I know. It was only later than that, after the events of the Dow, that he started trying to get, again, he's a talker, you know. put a microphone in front of Paul, he talks.
Was he a good talker?
Yes, quite good. Not as good as Bobby Cohen. Mm. Bobby Cohen was a real rabble-rouser type talker, but Paul isn't that good. But he's good. He's verbal. He's smart. He's clever. And he was by far the most consummate politician of all of them, you know. Paul, as I say, I don't think Paul ever did anything in his life that didn't test the water pretty thoroughly first. It wasn't very apparent that he was, but he's managed, you know, I think he's managed to do very well at it, and to stay in office this long, that's a pretty good record. But I don't really think he has any very profound philosophical conclusions about or basis for his politics. It's a politics. Maybe you don't get elected if you do. Or,
I was going to say, I'm not sure that was a requisite of office.
So Paul, I would just dismiss Paul as a minor figure. In now, he's been a smart enough politician to play that as if here's the young radical who led the campus through its strife and now is mayor and responsible and gets himself on TV with that image and so on. But that's pretty easy to do because newsmen don't do much homework, you know. They don't really look into things and try to find out whether these assumptions are correct. It makes a bad, much better story to have Paul, an important student leader during the radical days and now mayor, than it does to say that he was one of the second, third-rate people in the movement. So, or at least that's my view of it. And I think anybody who had anything to do with the student troubles around here would tell me the same thing about him, in terms of what his role was in the student movement.
I'd like to ask you about Joe Kaufman. You've mentioned him already several times. You must have known him.
Not very well. When I went into office, you see, Robin made the decision to go to sometime early summer to take the Michigan job. The search committee was a faculty search committee, you know. Mm-hmm. They didn't have students or regents on them in those days. And they soon came up with a list. Month's time, I think. And I know at least two names that were on the list.
Yeah, it was one of them, I know. Mm-hmm.
And I would be fairly sure, although I don't know it because nobody ever told me so, that Fred probably called Ed right away to see if he would like the job. Mm. And Ed was just early into his presidency at Maine, and I think he decided that he didn't want to get messed up with all those troubles and so on, and that he'd stay where he was. But I don't know that, but I think that's a fair inference. And then, but in any event, Fred called me over and asked if I would do it. And he gave me 2 or 3 or 4 days to think about it. I talked to only two people, my wife and Bert Fisher. And Bert thought I should do it. Well, I talked to Robin, of course. Mm-hmm. And I talked to, I meant outside of the administration. Mm-hmm. And of course I talked to Bob Clodius, who was very anxious that I do it. He was vice president at that time. And when I talked to Robin, he said, well, you know, I really think the worst of it's over. It's peaked. It's all downhill from here on. And he said, if I were you, I'd make Joe Kaufman vice president for student affairs. Let him handle everything. Hmm. And I talked to Fred Harrington, and he didn't, for his advice, and I didn't tell him what Robin had said. And he said, well, Joe can handle it. You don't need to worry about it. Just turn it all over to Joe. I wasn't at all satisfied, one, that it was all over, although I kind of believed that maybe it had peaked. You want to remember, looking back over it, that it's much easier now to see that it hadn't than it was.
Oh, yes,
at that
I know.
And there were a lot of people who are saying that the whole student movement had peaked. But I didn't quite believe that. But I thought, you know, maybe we'd learned how to deal with it a little bit. But I talked to a lot of people around the campus after I took office. Mm. Well, what shall I do about student affairs? Can I turn in OHL? Almost to a person, they said no. I talked to my friend Bert Fisher, to Bri Curl, to Leon Epstein, to all sorts of people. I talked to Dean Pound, even though I knew that he would be, you know, he was much more conservative about the whole thing. And I just got generally the story, well, Joe can't cope with it. That he's just, whatever great, whatever capacities he had for handling this, he's burned himself out. He's got no more goodwill among the students because of what he's had to do, and he's lost patience with the radical students. And you shouldn't. You can't fire him, but on the other hand, you shouldn't turn it over to him. And I still tried to turn everything I could over to Joe. But it was true. By then, Joe had gotten pretty gun-shy. He was terribly nervous. And another thing was going on. Joe was issuing edicts of various sorts without talking to me about
them. I wondered about that.
And he issued some edict about if they took a building or something like that, they would just have to have the police, and there'd be people thrown out of school and all that sort of thing. And he didn't talk to me about it first, but I learned later that he talked to Fred about it. And I think Fred had been putting the heat on Joe to do some of these things. I don't know.
That would have been extraordinary for him not to talk to you, I should think.
Well, it wasn't all that extraordinary because I told him to handle it, you know, and I didn't want anything to do with it.
Mm.